This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Democratic presidential candidates flock to Al Sharpton's convention, and insurance company Allstate loses a key post-Katrina lawsuit. Joining us today to talk about these stories and more, we've got Callie Crossley, commentator on the Boston television show Beat the Press, Robert George, an editorial writer at the New York Post, and a former senior writer for House Speaker Newt Gingrich from 1995 to 1998, plus Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education and co-director of immigration studies at New York University. So welcome, everybody, and let's talk about Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton is proving to be the man of the hour after his recent push to get the radio personality Don Imus off the air. Now, he has hosted all the major Democratic presidential candidates at his annual National Action Network convention last week, and the candidates were presumably vying for his endorsement. Now, former President Bill Clinton was there, hoping that Sharpton would endorse his wife, and all of this begs the question, is Sharpton now a kingmaker? I mean, last time around he was a candidate. Is he, Robert, a kingmaker this time?
Well, he's certainly vying for that role, Farai. You're right. I mean, his sense of timing was perfect in terms of pivoting off of the what can be considered a victory on the Imus front to in a sense having one of the larger cattle calls, political cattle calls of the of this ridiculously early presidential primary season, and it wasn't just obviously it wasn't just Hillary and Obama. He got some of the I guess what can be considered the secondary candidates, such as Joe Biden and Chris Dodd. Bill Richardson was there as well, and it's obvious he feels that he's going to have a certain amount of influence, here. I know, given that he's in New York, Hillary Clinton is definitely wants to try and get his endorsement. I think he's having fun right now. Being wooed by the entire field.
Marcelo, Reverend Al Sharpton is someone who often brings on strong feelings one way or the other. He's a champion of the black community, some people say. He's a liar, say others who think of the Tawana Brawley case. Why is this man in the center of the Democratic race right now in terms of building some kind of energy? Why do you think it's his turn?
Well, his voice is, as you suggest, a very, very strong voice, particularly on issues pertinent to a dynamic that has, a huge mathematical component to it. Let's face it, 75% of black voters are Democrats. This is compared to less than half of all white voters. He's a voice. He's a force to be reckoned with, and the political class is behaving in completely rational ways by courting him, by listening to him, by hearing his ambitions. This has to do with early positioning that will have important repercussions down the road. So at this point, what we're seeing here is a rational behavior in the part of the various early contenders for the Democratic primary behaving in ways that I think make sense.
Callie, is Reverend Al Sharpton missing a chance to run again for president? He ran in the 2004 elections. Do you think it's a wise decision for him to have moved out of that position, or should he go back and try to play that role?
Oh, no, I think it's absolutely a wise decision on his part to stay out of that fray. Why? When you can have a great amount of influence and have some opportunity to possibly influence the platform, not just by virtue of who you may or may not endorse, but by really having some influence on what the Democratic platform is and the shaping of policy in the future and access to a lot of other folks who consider themselves kingmakers. I mean, you know, he's in the best position to do what he always professes that he wants to do, which is to really shine a light on a lot of issues that African Americans have through a political framework. And that's why he established his National Action Network to begin with, so that he would have a platform and a forum from which to speak. And so I think that it just positions him to be able to do that.
And keep Keep in mind, Farai, you know, Al Sharpton is many things, but he's not stupid. He saw last time around, you know, even though he sort of presents himself as the heir to Jesse Jackson in some ways when it comes to black issues, his influence is not quite that high. I mean, when he ran 3 years ago, he didn't even get a majority of the black vote in, say, South Carolina or even in the District of Columbia. So I think he realizes wisely, particularly with the emergence of Barack Obama, that it would be something of an embarrassing run if he did, and it's a much wiser thing to try and influence the eventual nominee, whoever it is.
Go ahead, Kelly.
I was just going to say that I have to say, though, that what he also saw during that campaign was people really looking at him and saying, wow, there are some folks that who never would have said, I think Al Sharpton's making sense, who said, I think Al Sharpton's making sense. I can't believe this. You know, they really had a chance to, position himself as a statesman, and that I think he saw the benefit of that as well. So it wasn't just the sheer numbers. It was about really being able to encroach into that political influence-making circle.
I don't know if I would use the word statesman, but, you know, fair enough.
All right, well, let's move on, guys. I want to reintroduce everyone in case you're just tuning in. We've got Robert George, an editorial writer at the New York Post, Callie Crossley, commentator on the Boston television show Beat the Press, and Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at New York University. You're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea, and I want to move on to an Allstate lawsuit. The insurance company Allstate recently lost a key battle in the post-Katrina legal landscape. In New Orleans, a federal jury awarded more than $2.8 million to a man who lost his home in the storm, and the district court ruled that Allstate did not pay the complainant, Robert Weiss, enough money to cover wind damage. Now, it's a major victory for plaintiffs in other Katrina cases. Oregon attorney David Rossmiller, who writes about these cases, says, quote, insurers should worry about taking any case to a jury. So, Marcelo, do you think that this is a turning point in, you know, the lives of a lot of people who have been fighting long legal battles to try to get more money for the houses that they lost?
Hopefully. Mr. Rossmiller goes on to say that this is an eye-popping award, and in a way it really puts the insurance companies on notice here that the cases that henceforth will go to juries might produce findings and awards that are commensurate to the losses, the destruction, the pain, the suffering of the litigants in this case. So this is a turning point. I think that every jury moving forward is going to have to deal with this precedent.
Kelly?
Absolutely. And I also think that it just speaks to, you know, juries saying, can you see what happened? Hello, we can. Don't try to come in here and tell us it wasn't wind damage. It wasn't, you know, water damage. Come on. People paid their premiums. You know, pay up now. This is what they paid them for. So I think that's what he's speaking to about that as sort of emotional response that a jury would have. If you're a homeowner, certainly, you've looked at those pictures, and you can relate. So I think Marcelo is absolutely right. It's definitely a turning point.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we should keep in mind that it's not just, it's not just the pictures. It's not just pictures, really. I mean, there are actual literal details that have to be worked out in all these cases. But I will admit that having a judgment like this, I think will send a signal to the insurance companies that they may want to settle before they allow these things to go to trial. The downside of this, though, is, and I think this is something has to be kept in mind here, so will insurance companies want to go back into the Gulf region to insure if they realize that they may be subject to these kind of suits? And so it's a win, obviously, for the individuals here, but for people who want to be involved, who want to stay in the Gulf and want to rebuild there, they may find it difficult to get insurance at a reliable cost, at an affordable cost.
Well, I want to move on quickly to two more topics. I just want to warn in advance that the second of these two topics is, it may be inappropriate for young listeners or squeamish listeners, but this one is, I guess, kid-tested and, you know, safety-approved or something like that. The performance of the UN on of South Africa, on the UN Security Council has disappointed human rights activists who say that the values that of this multiracial nation with its constitution that upholds the rights of gays and lesbians is not really being championed by the nation in the UN. They have said not so much interested in Kosovo's bid for independence, backed Russian efforts to deny the Kosovo president the right to address the UN Security Council, haven't spoken up on Zimbabwe, haven't spoken up on violence in Burma. Should this government, Callie, be held to a higher standard because of what they went through?
I would hope so. It really is quite disappointing. And I think when you have a scenario like this where the rest of the world is trying to see where you're going to come down on issues that absolutely concerned your own government in fundamental ways. In fact, it informed the government's coming into being, the current one. So it's for them to side on the folks who would have been opposite them in the struggle of against apartheid is really quite disappointing and I think a little bit shocking, actually.
Marcelo?
Well, the issue here is really the transformation over time. Nelson Mandela had emerged as the moral voice in politics for almost a generation, really worldwide. And to see South Africa's voice in the Security Council, especially in the context of the atrocities in Burma, the human rights abuses in Zimbabwe, I think that more is expected of the current South African administration, and it is really this transformation over time that is very, very disappointing.
I mean, what a tragic irony that we have here that about two or three decades ago, South Africa and then Rhodesia were aligned as the last apartheid countries in the nation in the world, excuse me. And now South Africa and Zimbabwe, or South Africa is actually supporting Zimbabwe, the successor to Rhodesia, in being against human rights. I mean, I think it's just absolutely appalling. But I mean, we should have gotten a hint at this in terms of how South Africa has in the recent years, you know, treated AIDS policy, for example, buying into a lot of these conspiracy theories and so forth. And so, I mean, I think it's troubling and, as I said, appalling.
Okay, speaking of AIDS policy, this, we only have a little bit of time for it, but this is definitely a topic that is not for the squeamish and probably not for younger listeners. There is a rape epidemic in South Africa, and AIDS is transmitted through those rapes as well as through, you know, consensual sexual acts. Now there is a new female condom called Rapex, and it puts out sharp fishhook-like barbs on the interior that hook into the rapist and can only be removed surgically. Is this called for? Is this safe to put on the market, Callie?
Absolutely. Hooray to this woman. I mean, I think this is a brilliant thing. I mean, one of the things that you didn't say is that the little teeth mark things have to be removed by a physician, which does two things. First of all, it identifies the person, and it stops the action, obviously, but it also identifies the perpetrator. I'd like to see it exported here into the United States. I applaud this.
I guess that's where the rubber hits the road, right, Kelly?
Absolutely.
I would say that the what gives me slight pause on this, I think, certainly as a deterrent, it's not a bad idea. I'm wondering though what the health issues though are for women. I mean, you know, these are being obviously placed. Sensitively inside the woman, and they may be microscopic, but I mean, are there possible chances for infection and things like that? So before it becomes on the market, worldwide, I'd be a little bit wary about some of the health implications for women.
Marcelo, very briefly, do you think that this could become a problem if it's misused for revenge or other purposes?
Well, I can't see how it would be misused for revenge. I think I agree with Callie that This is not in fundamental ways different than Mays or other ways women should and do protect themselves. It's weapons of mass phallus destruction is what I would call it. And
oh
in sometimes, in some ways,
we have to wrap this up. But guys,
so to speak,
yeah, this is only you guys could crack jokes about a topic like this. From NPR New York, Marcelo Suarez Orozco, professor of globalization and education at New York University, Robert George, editorial writer at the New York Post, and Kelly Crossley of Beat the Press in Boston from the studios of Harvard University. Thank you guys so much.
That about covers it.
Thank you.
Thank you.